Hello, and welcome to Monday Night Playhouse. I'm Allison Seeley Smith, your host for our special series showcasing the work of African-Canadian writers and performers, a seven-week-long Black History Month special on Sunday Showcase. As artistic director of Obsidian Theatre Company, I've been privileged to work with many exciting emerging writers. And here at the CBC, we'd love to share with you just a small sample of the cornucopia of cultural expression coming out of the Black communities here in Canada. So, tonight, something a little bit different. A glimpse into the working process of four Canadian playwrights. Lisa Codrington is a new voice on the Canadian theatre scene. Her one-woman piece, Cast Iron, is being developed by Knightwood Theatre in Toronto. They're pretty excited about it, and when you give a listen to this, I think you'll understand why.
I started theatre, I think I got really interested in it when I was probably 12, when I was in junior high school. I went to a school with a great drama program, and we got to do all sorts of plays. We had a drama festival, but I never got to play really good parts. Like, I'd always end up being the dog or something like that, or the non-speaking role. But I really, really liked it, so I just kept with it. And from then on, I decided to go to university. And I'd always had really a lot of trouble with English and classes like that and spelling. I was a horrible speller. And I wrote an essay for a film class, and my film instructor was like, "You write well." And I thought, wow. I've never heard that before, and I never ever gotten that kind of support, and it just made me think, maybe I can write, and just believing that I could actually do it. I was at the University of Manitoba, and we had a class where we had to write a play in the style of a Canadian playwright. So I wrote a play in the style of Judith Thompson, and I thought, wow, this is really fun, and she's a really great playwright. I'd like love to be able to write like this woman. So from then, I sort of started writing things not for myself, but just writing things down, not necessarily plays, but just writing a lot, and my instructors were really supportive. And then when I came to Toronto, I had a really great creative performance class, and we did a lot of writing in it, and my instructor Sheldon Rosen always said, "You should keep writing. So I had a lot of support. I did this show for the Toronto Fringe Festival. I was at school, and I wanted to do the Fringe Festival in Toronto, and I thought, I'll just write a show. And then I thought, well, I'll just write a one-person show, because everybody's really busy. And so I thought, I'll just perform it. And so it sort of began that way.
Who the blast you think you is? And what the hell kind of monkey manners you use to enter the place? Before you walk in a room, you're supposed to knock, and then wait for me to say, who dat? Look, I don't care if the door open nor if the roof blow off. You must say who you is before you enter my room. Too late for that now. I already know who you is. And I know why you come.
Cast Iron is a play about Libby Atwell, and she's a Bajan immigrant living alone in a nursing home in Winnipeg. She's pretty much on her last days. She's getting ready to die, and she starts getting letters from her cousin's son in Barbados. And his father has just died, and his father has left Libby Atwell, the main character, his house in Barbados. But she's probably never going to go back there because she's very old. And the boy comes all the way from Barbados to Canada to ask if he can have the house. And Libya doesn't want to give him the house, even though she'll never live in it. And the play basically takes you from the Winnipeg nursing home back to Barbados, and it sort of lets you know why he can't have the house and what's wrong with the house and why Libya won't give it up.
Wait. What the hell you think you is doing? You can't come in here. Visiting hours is exactly 6:30 to 8, and them is strict. It's only a quarter past, so go along. You will have to come back later. I can't talk right now. I have exercise to do. Doctor, always threatening to cut off my legs if they get cold and stiff. So I have to keep the blood circulating.
I saw those type of people in nursing homes who came to this country years ago and are just alone now, and I've always wondered, what's their history like? Like, where have they come from?
I am too old to learn how to walk about in false foot, and too young to be pushed about in a wheelchair. Look, I can't do the exercise with you staring at me, so just go along and come back later. You have hard ears? I tell you, you can't come in here. Get out of my room. Don't close the door. Left it open. I don't want to be shut up in here with you. I don't like to be locked up in a room with no man. Get out.
She left a warm climate and a hot country with people who are a lot like herself to come to a cold Canada in Winnipeg where there's no one like her. So, and the place sort of tackles, why would someone leave this place and come to Canada? And what was sort of the impetus for that?
This room dirty. I'm full up with germs. This place need a good scrubbing and a whole bottle of bleach throw up on the flooring to kill the smell of the last soul who died here. I'm here 3 months now, and I could still see hair and smell stink all over the place. The only thing that clean is my bed. I soak my sheet with water every night just so as to get a new one put on in the morning. You lie if you think I'm going to let you sit by my bed, though.
Gracie is Libya's first cousin. When Libya was really young, her father dropped her off at her grandmother's house and ceased to pick her up. So he just never came back for her because his wife had just left him and he sort of started to gain a habit of gambling. So Libya ended up living at her grandmother's house with her cousin Gracie, and Gracie was a very proud child, and she'd never let Libya play with her, and she sort of exiled Libya from all of her games, I think essentially because Gracie was a bit jealous of Libya.
Let me start my game. It's called Name Every Piece of Sugar Cane in Winston Plantation. My plantation. My mummy say that everything is need a name, or else they get taken up by the devil and die in shame. But it's a dangerous game running through Winston Plantation sugar cane. People is get caught up running through the cane. All except those that is related by name. So, that why all the one that can only come in this cane if I give a piece of it your name, because I own it.
It's a whole new vocabulary for me, just writing in the dialect, the Bajan dialect. So I would just call my family when I would be in Toronto, and I'd call them and I'd say, what's the word for pants? Or if there was something that I couldn't get and there was a rhythm I couldn't find, and I would just say, what's the word for shoes? Like, do you call shoes shoes or do you call them something else?
She escaped the red woman attack. Old Charles Winston, who first owned this cane, get he meat from the butcher who lived down the lane. But this one time, the butcher had found that she ain't having the meat for Charles Winston to eat. So she killed some loud-mouthed children in the cane and wrapped them up like meat as if they're the same. But when she business get back on her feet and she bring Charles Winston sweet pig meat to eat, he say, this ain't as sweet as the meat I get last week. So she run through the cane and start cutting again. And when she hands start to turn red, people change and call she the red woman instead. The old people say she die, but I think it is a bundle of lie. So if you see the red woman coming up the lane, stop where you is and shout out, it gonna rain. Okay? So, if I find anyone here all sucking on the stalk or stealing from the crop, I will call for the red woman to chase you till you drop. And after I don't wanna stop, I gonna get she to cut off your top. Now, all I wanna please come run behind me and hold tight to the cane that I give you to name. All I wanna come, we's gonna make some fun.
I think I really drew on the stories that I get told. Because the people that I know from Barbados, being from Winnipeg, are my parents' generation. So all those people who immigrated from Barbados and came to Canada in like the late 60s and the early 70s, and listening to them talk about Barbados and talking about going home or not going home, and just listening to the world that they saw then, and then when they go back, talking about the world that there is now, and just being really attentive on it. Because I've always loved to just listen to and hear about Barbados, because I think it's fascinating. And I've always wanted my family to have really deep accents, because I just think it's cool. So,
you see she out there? No, don't look! She might see you. The drape's drawn. Just peek out the side, so. But don't shake the drapes. Oh, my. Oh, look. You see she? She in a broad-rim hat and wearing a flower-print top tucked into a green A-line skirt. She peeping in the window straight back at we. You see she red hands and sharp cleaver knife. Libya, I know she want to take my life. Look. Hold tight upon the cast iron and make sure the door lock. If look. Okay. If she come in here, you know. Okay, Libya, my girl. Okay, just quick so with the cast iron. Look. Keep your eyes on the window.
Stacey May is Libya's grandmother.
Sorry,
and
girl.
She has lived in a house just outside of Winston Plantation sugarcane field her entire life. And her mother has told her many stories about how she came to be and why she must stay in this house. And basically, Stacey May is homebound. She's scared to leave the house.
In the old days, this house used to be a slave quarters. It's where the master come to pick up what slave he want to do what. He'd do it just like he'd picking what shirt he want to put on. That was my great-grandfather. I never meet he. I ain't even know my grandfather, and we was alive at the same time. He used to own Winston Sugarcane Plantation. He never used this place as slave quarters, but what he do with it was the same thing. Is where he'd take young black girls. Well, actually, he take them in the cane field and boom! When the belly get big with baby, he bring them to this house to get the child cut out. And the red woman is who do it. She do it on she way to deliver meat. Coming into the house, playing butcher, with one package of meat in she right hand and a empty sheet in she left. But look, girl, when she left, she have 2 package of meat. This is the truth. My mother tell me. Once, when my mother was a little girl, she followed the red woman. And watched she bury the package with the baby in the sugar cane and deliver the meat to my grandfather. But one time the red woman get the packages mixed up and my grandfather get a meat he ain't expect. That is how my mother know that when she father tell she to come to this house, it was because he had find out she was pregnant by my father. Black and white door mix. But my mother remember what she see, and she lock the door tight. And that is what I do too. 'Cause the red woman, she don't give up fast.
There are a lot of characters that are made up of people I've met in Winnipeg that are from Barbados, and people in Barbados, and people that I met in England as well, family in England, just seeing all their different experiences as immigrants in these countries. And it's always like somebody might tell you a story and they don't know the entire story, and you think, wow, I'm going to finish that. And you just sort of have an imagination with it, and you just sort of make up a story like, oh, I think this must have happened. That's why this happened. And, I mean, it's not necessarily my family story, but it's It's sort of like how I think maybe some things in Barbados came to be, or how some people came to Canada, ended up here.
Now you're playing smart. This morning you come and we talk business quiet and so. Every time I come, you're making excuses and trying to put it off. Now you're burning
Sparrow, let me go. Why don't hold me so? Me mama won't know. Sparrow, darling, wait till tomorrow. Teresa, I love you. And I always thinking of you. Yo te quiero mucho. I really can't wait till tomorrow.
Black Theatre Workshop in Montreal is one of Canada's oldest black theatre companies, spanning a career of 30 years of nurturing great playwrights. A shining example of their work is Vadney Haynes.
Good evening, and welcome to the Funny Bones Comedy Club. You've heard that the government wants to hire more visible minorities for the civil service, but it says that it's having a hard time finding any. Really? Can you imagine not being able to find me? Look at me.
Hi, my name is Vadney S. Haynes, and I wrote this play, Blacks Don't Bowl, which is currently in development at BTW, Black Theatre Workshop, here in Montreal. I first wrote it as a way of addressing what for me is a very important issue, and that is identity.
Now, some of you must be confused, what with all the name changes over the years. You're not sure what to call us or what you can call us. It's African-Americans or Canadians, not people of color, not blacks, not Afro-Americans. African-Americans. I think, why not something politically correct, like melanin-enhanced or people of the pigment?
Identity is a mixed bag, if you will. It's a double-edged sword in that it provides essential, necessary structure. It defines who you are and who you're not, inside and outside. And at the same time, it also provides or creates an unnecessary stricture in that it limits what you do, how you see things, how you feel about things, what you think about, what you even allow yourself to think about.
Okay. Mugshots. Aren't those pictures of criminals something else? They're always ugly, mean-looking, and scary. We assume that that's what natural-born criminals look like, but maybe it's the other way around. It could be that these people were just born looking that way, unfortunate as may be, and they look at their own pictures and say, shit, with a face like that, what kind of job am I ever going to get? Who's going to hire me? Might as well become a criminal. I think it should be an acceptable legal defense to say that it was their face that made them do it.
For me, the play is a big question mark, because I wanted the audience to leave questioning themselves about their identity, how their identity has shaped their lives, what they do and what they don't do.
As I have said, our problem is not white people. Our problem is not having white hair. We come to terms with that, and we may well be on our way to some inner peace, better able to deal with white people. So I say to you, don't worry, be nappy.
I wanted to look at black identity because how black people define themselves, how black people allow themselves to be defined, is so important because it determines or can determine what they do, where they go, what they think about their decisions and choices. And I wanted people to make sure that whatever that identity was, it was one that they freely and consciously chose for themselves.
You know, I used to resent growing up in a West Indian family. Being a kid in one of those families is not easy. Even though I was too young to be able to put it into words, I knew something was missing. It was only as I got older that I was able to say what it was. Sympathy. West Indian parents do not give kids any sympathy whatsoever. Something bad happens to you, and you turn to them for a little solace, understanding, forget it. You'll come away empty-handed and empty-hearted. You know how kids can be really quirky, like not wanting the different foods on their plate to touch? Don't let the peas touch the potatoes. They touched. And then the kid runs horrified from the table. White parents run after them. Oh, they're there. Oh, it's okay. Oh, that'll never happen again. Oh, would you like some ice cream? West Indian house? Oh, no, the peas touched the potatoes. Oh, yeah? That's a problem. Here, come here. Let me fix it for you. Smash, 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 smash. There. Now everything's one. All together. Now eat it. And don't even think about not eating it. No sympathy. No sensitivity. So frustrating. It bugged me for the longest time. And then it struck me a while ago that West Indian parents treat their kids that way as a way of preparing them for an insensitive world where, as a black person, you can't expect to get a lot of sympathy.
Pinto is both an insider and an outsider. He's black, so he's on the inside of blackness, but at the same time, he's on the outside. And like any artist, any good, true artist, he is able to comment on things and in a way that most people don't, but in so doing, allow people to think about things that they normally don't think about.
Most orgasms last for 7 seconds. 7 seconds. Yeah, they do. I've timed it. All that huffing and puffing, not to mention the planning and scheming for 7 seconds of screeching and whimpering. Oh, well. But it's probably a good thing that it doesn't last much longer, because you've lost 7 seconds of dignity, higher brain function, and the ability to say anything other than references to the deity. 7 seconds of that is enough. I recently heard that pigs have orgasms that last for 30 minutes. 30 minutes! No wonder bacon tastes so good. If I had an orgasms that lasted 30 minutes, I'd want to eat me too.
He's called Pinto, but I toyed with the idea that his real name is Cassandro, in that he is a kind of, soothsayer. He's a kind of individual who sees things and points them out that the rest of society doesn't see or is able to readily discern.
I just recently read an article in the paper that talked about a study of Canadian sexual habits. They were asked how many times in the last week did they have sex. 38% said once. 17% said 2 or 3 times. 14% reported 4 or 5, and so on. But the best part was the 8% who said they didn't know. They didn't know. How can you not know? It's very simple. During the last 7 days, did you get on top of someone, or did someone get on top of you, during which time there was a tingling sensation in your pelvic area, and at the end of which you had a desire to sleep or do your nails? Now, I know that they did not have black people in that sample, because black people know when they've had sex. Everybody knows when a black person's had sex.
Could I be that stand-up comedian? How does he do it? How does she get up there and do that? I could never do that. Well, maybe I could. Questions of identity.
Oh, the personalized. Well, hold on a second. Let me read you a few, okay? Big, blonde, buxom. Open to new, and I do mean new experiences. I've got buttons no one has ever pushed before. Are you man enough to rise and fall to the occasion? If this excites you, call me soon. If this scares you, call right away.
I could not see myself up on stage as a stand-up comedian. So I guess I put those words and that persona onto Pinto. And he does what, in some ways, a lot of people would like to be able to do, to comment on things in a different guise or different form.
One more. Single professional black male in his mid-30s enjoys good conversation and the finer things in life, such as moonlight walks, candlelight dining by the fireplace, bowling. I don't think so. A brother did not write that. That's a white guy trying to pass himself off as black. Moonlight walks, bowling? That's definitely a white guy. How can I be so certain? Well, that's because most people secretly want to be one of three things they're not. Italian, black, or a woman. You don't believe me? Look around, you'll see. A brother bowling? The whole bowling motion is at odds with the way black people carry ourselves. You've seen the way we walk. All of that runs counter to the bowling motion. It's just not in our musculature. White people don't walk like we do, or at least they're not supposed to, and when they do, it catches your attention, doesn't it? And besides, whenever a black person has tried to bowl, they've ended up with a strange desire afterwards to listen to ABBA or watch Walton reruns. I'm issuing a warning right now to black people. Repeated attempts to bowling can cause severe muscular discomfort and a bad record collection. You've been warned.
People have asked me if I'm going to write another play, and my answer usually is, I don't think so, because I don't consider myself a playwright. I consider myself as someone who's written a play because of what I wanted to say in Blacks Don't Bowl. I'm not a writer as such. I spend most of my time teaching. I teach psychology in the psychology department of Champlain College here in the Montreal area. And I am a psychotherapist in private practice where I do individual, adult, and marital therapy. I don't need to write another play. Whatever need I had, I think, has been exhausted in writing Blacks Don't Bowl. And hopefully the play will become produced at some point, and that will be heard. Those questions will be asked. Those answers that people hopefully will provide for themselves will be there as well.
Mainstream art needs all that unacceptable, threatening shit. Otherwise, it would die. So all you niggas out there, the world needs us. As you leave here tonight, keep repeating to yourself, I am a work of art. I am a work of art. Now, some of you are a work in progress, and some others could use some fresh paint, but I can still see your beauty. Remember, I am a work of art.
In the event that you've been wondering, what you've been listening to is Blacks Don't Bowl, written by me, Vadney S. Haynes. Excerpts from the play were performed by Andrew Moody. Thanks for listening.
This world is not my home.
Diane Roberts is known to Toronto audiences as a very skilled and talented dramaturge and director. However, we've caught her in a new role in Montreal at Black Theatre Workshop, where she's currently working on a few scenes from her brand new piece, Bone Bread.
I mean, I had a pretty normal childhood, except that I was pretty well the only black kid in my school, both in Montreal and here in Toronto. So I think I always had the feeling of being outside and trying to fit in. Just like any young black kid, I found myself often quite isolated.
This world is not my home.
Well, I found that actually just playing a role was really fun. I was able to step out of my skin in a way. So that, for me, at the time, color wasn't really as much of an issue. It wasn't until I went to university that color became an issue in terms of the roles I was playing. And the roles that I chose, because we were allowed to choose our roles from the plays that they had given us, were always these strong women, like just these strong, powerful women, like Medea. You know, I really did get into Medea as well. I must have been introduced to it in high school. But it really came to me in university. I took a trip to London, and I saw Diana Rigg play Medea on a main stage in the West End, and I was just blown away by that. And it was at that moment that I said, that character could be black. Medea could be black.
Once, a handsome stranger came into a certain village and strolled about among the people in mysterious silence. All the maidens admired him and wished that he would choose one of them for his bride. But he said nothing, and at last walked away into the forest and disappeared from sight. A month later, the stranger came again. And this time, one of the maidens fell so much in love that she resolved to follow him into the forest, as she could not bear to be separated from him. When the stranger looked back and saw her coming behind, he stopped and told her to return home, but she would not. In defiance, she cried out,
"I will never leave you, and wherever you go, I will follow."
"Beautiful maiden, you will regret it."
It came as an assignment from my professor, Judith Rudikoff. She gave me a 2-week assignment to write an adaptation of any play I wanted, in any style. Right away, I knew it was going to be Medea. I just started writing. I chose New Orleans as a starting place. So we did some research into the history and background of New Orleans around the time of just post-emancipation. Just when freedom was just, like, you could still taste it in your mouth. I liked that, the resonance of that timing. And New Orleans, for me, it was all about the Mardi Gras, the ritual. I knew that I wanted to use Voodoo as her source of ritual power. So I started in New Orleans, and then I wanted to trace it back. So I had to trace her story back. So how did she get to New Orleans, and where was her original home? Because in the original story, she's taken from her original land and brought to the New World. So what was her original home? So I traced it back to Haiti. I started to realize that the ongoing obsession in this play is about home and seeking after home. And I think that certainly relates to me.
Oh, Lord, how long? How long will it be before we leave this forsaken place? This land of false promises and broken dreams.
My mom's from Grenada, and my father is from St. Vincent, and I was born in England. So when we came to Canada, we actually immigrated to Montreal. And then about age 8 or so, grade 2, I moved to Toronto. My mom used to tell me my grandfather was half Scottish and my grandmother was part French, and I would say, okay, well, that's interesting, but why am I black? Oh, well, that was your father's side of the family. But because my own background is so split, and then beyond that, I don't know what's beyond that.
And now we have only to boast about survival. No, we were never slaves. Though we are exiled to this pit of Maya, this sewage dump, these shores where shit stays stagnant, where we know nothing but the memory of our songs.
The line in the play where the midwife says, "We were never slaves." I remember my mom saying that, because I used to say, "Well, why am I black? Were we not descendants of slaves?" No, we were never slaves. Yeah.
Safe and secure from all alarms, leaning, leaning, leaning on the everlasting arms.
I grew up in a Brethren church. They did a lot of missionary work in the West Indies. So a lot of these Brethren churches, well, it's called a Bible-believing church, so it's really like the Word of God is the Word of God. And women have a specific role. They really like Paul. In my growing up, I found it a bit oppressive, and it was very much woven into the fabric of my being. Like the whole Christianity thing, the voice just started to come into that.
The leopard would catch her after all.
So it came out naturally.
"Greetings, teacher, father. Greetings to the glory of God.
There is no one blessed in this house.
The richest blessings come from heaven above and not from things on earth."
And then the struggle between the Yoruban based religion and the Christianity became, that conflict just sort of appeared. So I started working on that in another draft, working on that a little bit more. And what is that conflict? What does it mean? And then I started realizing that that conflict is in me. You know, so then, so as I go further into the play, I realize how much of me is in it.
My path has led me here.
Well, you're most welcome.
After I wrote it, and it became my master's thesis, and after I wrote it, I had some medical problems, and I actually had a fall. I fell off my balcony. I was laid up for a good 2 or 3 years. I was still sort of working, but it was very, very difficult for me to function at the level that I was originally functioning at. And I went back to the play and started to try to read it. And I couldn't, because I realized that what I had written, my body had written 3 years previous. So that all of the medical stuff that I had experienced and all of the, and the fall, I mean, it was called Fallen, it was in the play. And that, once it became Bone Bread, that's when I finally started to know what this play was going to be. Like, as soon as I adopted that name, as Fallen, it wasn't really, it didn't feel right. Like, it still felt like an adaptation.
Celestine's departure.
Bone Bread now feels like it's more my play.
You were a strong family, a strong community.
Crane comes in. I mean, in the original story, Creon comes to get rid of Medea, to tell her that she's banished. So what I wanted to do with that scene was, I was really interested in this idea of denying one's own heritage. So that's what Crane is all about. He's really in denial of his heritage. And she actually gains power from that scene, whereas before she was feeling very abandoned, like she was feeling small. After this scene, she actually rediscovers her own power.
You have your orders. These men will escort you to the city limits.
A fatherless child does not fight an unjust fight. You and I are not so different after all.
We're different by our very natures. You should know that. I love my family more than what you call truth.
And for that to destroy my family?
No one asked you to come here. You knew the risks.
And you hold the news.
Your marriage was an embarrassment to the laws of this state. Spared for a time by the citizens who loved you with a reverent fear. And you were granted a temporary home.
Let us know,
the political winds have changed, and you are no longer
so
an asset. In fact, you've become a burden to Jason, this town, and to my daughter. What are you mumbling?
I'm praying for wisdom and to you for mercy.
You are the mirror of my ugliness. Don't you see it? You undermine the struggle of all men for freedom, black and white. You don't seek progress. Your only interest is revenge. By removing you is as much a service to your children as it is to this town.
Oh, let us nobly die so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us to death. Ancestral spirits, we must meet the common foe.
It feels like it's been an epic journey for me to actually get through and understand. Because when I wrote the play, it was written from another place. And for me, writing this play was like coming to myself. Writing this play was like coming to myself. Like, you know, where you have to sort of go through, at some point, you have to go through that journey of renaissance, I guess, of going back and figuring out, where did I come from? Why am I here? And all of that stuff. That's how it's sort of, I guess, the play has affected me.
In his story, he told her that though he was allowed once a month to wander about in villages and towns like a man, he was in reality a savage leopard that would rend her in pieces as soon as he regained his natural form. With these words, he flung himself upon the ground and immediately became a snarling leopard and began to pursue the terrified girl. They ran for a great distance, through valleys, up mountains, cutting through thistles and heavy bush. After what seemed to be a marathon chase, the young woman came upon a deep and narrow river which she could not cross.
My life obsession is about straining towards home. You know, and I like that. I like that because it just, I like that momentum. Like, as long as I'm still straining and not lying back and saying, oh, I wish, you know, I still feel like I'm on the road, and I'll know when it's over.
Scenes from the play Bone Bread were written and directed by Diane Roberts and recorded in the rehearsal hall at Black Theater Workshop in Montreal. The actors were Chimwemwe Miller as Andreas, Crane, and the teacher, Mirai Metellus as Celestine, and Audrey Zina Mandiela as the midwife.
You've been getting glimpses, we've been sharing samples of the kind of wonderful things that are happening on the Black Theatre scene here in Toronto. So, just for something a bit different, here is a small but complete piece. Joseph Pierre is a strong new cutting-edge voice on the Toronto theatre scene. And to show you what I mean, here's a piece called Beatdown, a.k.a. Life.
There was a time when I would walk the streets like a Black Panther. Every step I took self-assured. Every breath I took with purpose. But the streets ain't the same no more. My steps ain't the same no more. The breath just ain't like it used to be. Am I in control of this chaos? Or is this chaos in control of me? I don't know. I just wish I knew how to move like that panther again.
I want to ask you something.
That's all you've been doing for the past hour.
You don't want to answer me?
You can pout those rosy cheeks all you want to pout. I've had enough questions.
You really don't want to answer me.
Damn. All right, go on. Ask your question.
What were you thinking when you first saw me?
Oh, shit. I need another drink before I answer that.
Come on.
I was thinking, if I get you in bed, I better not disappoint you.
The very first time.
You're crazy, huh? Well, I couldn't have you going back to Rosedale talking about a brother couldn't handle his.
Like I'm that type of woman.
Hey, better safe than sorry. Plus, you was loving all that bed shaking anyway.
I ask you a serious question, and you just wiggle your way out of it.
Hell nah. Look, I gave you a serious answer. Look, it might not have been the one you wanted to hear, but that's not what you asked for.
Well, how about now, then? What do you think about us now?
Whoa. This conversation's getting a little intense. You sure you want to go there?
I need for you to go there.
Need?
Yes, Jay.
Look, Lindsay, I care about you. You know that.
People can care about a lot of different things on a lot of different levels.
Look, obviously I ain't answering you the way you want me to because you got something else going on in your head. But just come clean with me, baby. Tell me what's going on.
I want to be more than this late night rendezvous.
You are.
I don't want to be a hoe.
No more, okay?
I'm not a hoe,
no
you know
more.
That. I don't want to ever think of myself
That's
as a hoe.
That's not what you are to me. You get that out of your head.
Jay Kreese, I'm pregnant.
What do you mean?
I'm pregnant.
No, you can't be pregnant. You can't come drop this on me.
I am.
Well, listen to me. That's past tense. You were pregnant because you're not having that baby.
You want me to have an abortion?
Yes! Yes!
Jay, let's sit down and let's talk about
this. No, I'm not talking my business from all these people, all right? You want to go outside? We'll talk outside.
You didn't think what?
You see this angry.
This angry?
No!
Oh, no, you're expecting old Jay to hug you and say thank you for this half-breed bastard.
How did you say that?
With the same ease, you ruined my day.
It wasn't easy for me to tell you.
Well, yeah, well, doesn't that just change everything?
I didn't expect it, but I wasn't angry when I found out.
Yeah, why would you be angry? All this time telling me you're on the pill when you were just waiting for the half-breed.
No.
What? What? You wanted curly hair?
I was on the pill.
But then you stopped.
I never stopped. How can you think I'd be that petty? Go through hell for curly hair?
Well, you never stopped. So what? So what? You saying I got super sperm?
Don't do this to me, Jake.
If you wanted a black man, there's a lot of better candidates to have a kid with.
You approached me. Don't forget that.
Hugging me up when you knew. You knew.
It's not that bad.
You think you can handle having a little kid?
We can handle.
I'm a drug dealer, okay? Ain't no more to it.
You're much more.
No, you're damn smart. Now look at me. Do I look like somebody's father? Do I look like I can be somebody's father?
We can work through it.
Oh, yeah. We can work through it, all right. Yeah, me and you and your mom and your dad. You know, if you understood this world, if you knew how nasty it was, you'd thank me for good advice. This ain't no world for no kid.
You're an expert about everything. You know how everything works.
Look, I don't know anything.
You know. You know so much, and still you can't be man enough to just admit that it's me. Me and my intimidating white face.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you and your intimidating white face. Good enough to screw, but not good enough to have a kid with.
I can handle that.
Ah! Look, it has nothing to do with that. I'm through with politics. You've known from the start, we don't have time for that shit no more.
You're through with me.
Look, I'm not saying that I'm through with you. I'm saying I'm not having no kid.
Then you're through with me.
Don't say shit you can't live by.
Get away from me.
No, Lindsay.
Get away from me.
You know what? Screw it. Screw it. If that's how you want to make your bed, you make your bed.
You disappoint me.
I disappoint you. Yeah, I disappoint you. Yeah, what can I say, baby? I'm an asshole, no doubt. But I ain't nobody's father. Tarina! Tarina!
What's going on? Plan on breaking down my door?
Nah.
It's a bit early for a booty call, don't you think?
Come on, that's the last thing on my mind.
Kind of disappointed. The first thing on mine.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of disappointment going down tonight.
I was only playing with you. Why are you so edgy? Twitching like a crackhead.
I got reason to be twitching.
You know I'm here for you, Jay. I like seeing you in this state.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, somebody's master plan to have me in this state. Somebody getting their jollies off of this.
Getting their jollies off of what?
Off of me having no control. You know, brother can't make it out there without no control.
Well, I'm lost. I don't know what you mean.
Man, that girl, she sent my world rocking.
Which girl?
Lindsay. She's gonna act all nonchalant and then tell me that she's pregnant. Do you hear me?
I heard you.
I'm not built to be a father.
Jayquees, you don't even know how much you have to offer.
Man, I'm a hustler. I'm hustling my way through this world. I'm on the ground level, Tarina. I know what this world is really about. I know how cutthroat it really is. It's not for no kid.
Maybe you need to stop being on the ground level. Maybe this is a sign for you to leave the streets.
The streets need me. It's the realest thing there is. I can't bounce from this game.
This game that you're trapped in, that you're a part of? You need to think about this game. This is hell that you're inhabiting. All these brothers walking around heartless. Because they born in this game with low self-esteem, no esteem, no self. This game just grabbed them up and filled them with something, and they think it's esteem, but it ain't. They don't know. They can't see the overall picture. It's too immense. I mean, all these brothers walking around with this pumped up bravado, they ain't thinking about living. They're thinking about killing.
I make money.
You make money. How do you make money? By dealing. And if the white man is the devil, then screw it. Black folks are his henchmen. Because the devil is what's wrong, and you're doing wrong. Are you the hand of the devil, Jayquees? Or are you caught in the game?
The devil ain't just no white man, baby. He's too damn smart to keep just being the white man when we done found him out. See, he's changing colors. He's the whole world.
Yes, he is, but we killing ourselves. We're making it hard to fight against what we really need to fight against. You don't feel the danger of what you're part of because your mentality is built around this danger. I know you're trying to make money, but you'll go to any extent, then the other man will go to any extent. Then we have a society of people with money who don't see life.
Life, girl. This is life. This is Darwinism. This is survival of the fittest. This is life. This is fighting back. This is gaining things for yourself. See, I'm a man with money in this game. I'm a man with a gun. See, that's the deadliest kind.
Money is a house. Money is a car. You're small time. You're busy beating your feet on the pavement. You're putting your life on the line for nothing. And you alone know 50 brothers with a gun. So who's the deadliest?
You don't understand the game. This game been played throughout history.
Throughout history, the only people who die are those in the game. Y'all killing for the same recycled $50.
There ain't nobody dying for no $50.
Sorry, they die for less.
Look, I didn't write no rules.
Why are you playing by them?
Look, I came to you because I'm stressed out. I mean, that white girl just told me she's pregnant, and now you're telling me this bullshit.
I'm just showing you the world this kid is going to be a part of if you're not in his life. Because if your mind is made up, I agree with you. Let her have an abortion. We got enough little black boys who have moms who ain't nobody's wife.
I told that girl, go on the pill. I even said it slowly. I said, go on the pill. If I could have said it in Spanish, believe me, I would have said it in Spanish too.
You don't know if she wasn't.
It doesn't matter. What matters is that she does what needs to be done.
Jake Weiss.
Do I look like a friggin' father? No, come on, be real with me. Do I look like a friggin' father?
Obviously, she cares about you.
Man, maybe I should have just made this a booty call like you wanted.
Oh, smooth, very smooth.
No, I just cause tension. I cause tension wherever I go.
If push comes to shove, you might not care if you kill somebody. I'm not sure if you care if the girl died. But I never thought you'd want to see yourself die again.
What?
This baby is just you again. Be a man.
I don't need this. I'm out.
Hello?
Hey.
Jay?
Yeah, it's me, B. It's me.
It's 3 in the morning. Jay? What's going on? Where are you?
Danforth Bridge.
What are you doing there?
I'm watching cars. Thinking about a lot of things.
Are you all right?
Look at you. I spazzed on your ass, and here you are asking if I'm all right.
Jay.
Baby, I don't know how to let you in on what's going on in my head. I don't know how to say them things. I don't know how to let you feel them things. But I gotta quiet those demons on my own. I ain't gonna bail on you. We gonna try and make this work.
I'm Joseph Perrin, that was my play, Beatdown. You heard Kevin Hanchard as Jay Queese, Amy Rutherford was Lindsay, and Miranda Edwards as Tarina. The play was recorded by Joe Mahoney and directed by Phil Aiken. The producer was Bill Lane. Once again, thanks for listening. See you later.
On Monday Night Playhouse, you've just heard the Out Front anthology that's part of CBC Radio's Black History Month celebration. I'm Damiano Pietropaolo, executive producer of the Black History Month special, with guest host Allison Seeley Smith. Now, Allison, next week, we're on our fourth stop along our seven-part journey through black culture in this country. And I believe we're co-producing something that sounds like Canada.
That's right. A very special something. It's a special live-to-ear broadcast that will be happening on Friday morning, February 27th, coming to you live from the Textile Museum of Canada in Toronto. Sounds Like Canada with host Sheila Rogers will be presenting an exciting hour of stories, music, poetry, drama, and conversation with artists of African-Canadian heritage, all designed to explore the theme of home.
Well, sounds like Canada indeed.
It does indeed.
And if you miss it on Friday morning on CBC Radio 1, you can hear it right here on Sunday Showcase and Monday Night Playhouse next week, same time, same place, with your guest host, Allison Seeley Smith. See you then.
I'll be here.
Many of the dramas you hear on our show are available on CD. For more details, you can go to our website or you can phone 416-205-5966 or email us at radiodramaoncd@toronto.cbc.ca. That's it for tonight. For our Black History Month special on CBC Radio, I'm executive producer Damiano Pietropaolo. Stay with us now for After Hours on CBC Radio 2. Good night.
You're tuned to CBC Radio 2, Classics and Beyond, in Ottawa at 103.3 FM.
One of Canada's most anticipated literary events comes to the Museum of Civilization on Tuesday night, and you're invited. Join me, Alan Neal from Ontario Today, and His Excellency John Ralston Saul for the CBC Literary Awards. Come and celebrate with Canada's finest writers. The show begins at 7 o'clock in the Great Hall of the Museum of Civilization. It's the CBC Literary Awards, Tuesday evening, in partnership with the Canada Council for the Arts and En Route Magazine.
Here is the CBC News. I'm Rafi Vigod. Rebel leaders in Haiti have set their sights on Port-au-Prince as their three-week uprising continues. Pro-government militants have set up burning barricades outside the capital in an effort to keep the rebels out. But the main opposition group said today it will give the international community 24 hours to work out a better peace plan. The Democratic platform says U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell made the request for the delay this morning. Stephen Puddicombe is in Haiti's capital and sends this report.
The main opposition party says it will give the international community time to come up with a better deal, but that deal has to include President Jean-Bertrand Aristide leaving office. The Democratic platform says Powell didn't make any specific promises, and it's not holding out hope that anything will change in the next 24 hours. The leaders of the group say Colin Powell doesn't understand the volatile situation that exists in Haiti today. One of the leaders says Powell in Creole means does not see. The group says it doesn't trust Aristide, saying he has broken many promises in the past and is willing to promise anything to stay in power. They say the only way to avoid further violence, bloodshed, and killing is by the president stepping down. The Democratic platform also distanced itself from the rebels that have been fighting in the northern part of the country. It has appealed to both the rebels and the pro-government forces to stop fighting. The group says it's caught between the crush of the rebels in the north and the terror that reigns in the presidential palace. Stephen Puddicombe, CBC News, Port-au-Prince.
Former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien testified in a Calgary courtroom today. Chrétien was called as a witness in a billion-dollar lawsuit against the federal government. The Samson-Cree Nation claims Ottawa mismanaged the band's oil and gas royalties for more than 30 years. Chrétien was Indian Affairs Minister in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Samson lawyer Jim O'Reilly says Chrétien has an important role to play.
I can't comment too much because the case is actually pending and it's ongoing, but he certainly gave a very useful perspective to how the government of Canada approached the whole problem of this Indian Act and the developments going towards the constitutional amendments and how it viewed its trustee relationship.
Chrétien had little information to offer in some of his testimony because he said it's been a long time since he was Indian Affairs Minister. He did say the Indian Act is an embarrassment and should be abolished. Chrétien is expected to testify for at least one more day. BC's provincial health officer says initial testing of three Abbotsford farm workers does not show any link to an avian flu that was discovered among thousands of chickens last week. The chickens were slaughtered to keep the disease from spreading. A security zone is in effect, and further tests will be conducted. Judgment has been reserved in the case of a man fighting federal officials over an election gag law. Paul Bryan is accused of breaking the law by releasing federal election results on the internet before the polls had closed in the West. The BC Supreme Court dismissed the charges last fall. Elections Canada is challenging that ruling. Bryan says the law is outdated and the Supreme Court ruling should stand.
What we're talking about here is a law that was enacted at the time of the telegraph. And, you know, a lot has changed since then. We don't go to the railroad to get our information sent by Morse code to somebody to get it across the nation. We walk up to our computers or our cell phones and we transmit information to each other like that.
Lawyers say it could be several weeks before the judge announces his decision. Toronto's police chief has expressed concern that escalating violence may be hurting the city's international image. Julian Fantino is pleading for public assistance in solving the latest murders. The weekend killings include the stabbing death of a University of Havana student at a travel agency and the fatal shooting of a high-profile music manager. The violence brought the number of murders in Toronto this year to 9, compared with 3 homicides at the same time last year. Canada's premiers and territorial leaders are in Vancouver today and tomorrow for the first meeting of the Council of the Federation. The Council was established to address interprovincial issues. This is its first meeting. Discussions are expected to focus almost entirely on health care reform. And that's the CBC News.
Here's the weather forecast for the National Capital Region. Clear skies overnight with a low of minus 16 degrees. Sunny on Tuesday with a high of minus 3. Continuing sunny on Wednesday, the high minus 5, the overnight low minus 14. A carbon copy on Thursday, the high minus 5, the low minus 14 under sunny skies. And then continuing sunny on Friday with a high of minus 3 degrees, a low of minus 11. This is CBC Radio 2, 103.3 in Ottawa.